Hi, welcome to On the Line. We got a great show for you all tonight. Thanks for tuning in. Real excited about our panel. Let's just go ahead and introduce everybody. We got Carlos Chavez.
Hey guys, good to see you again.
Joining us for the first time tonight, Daily Wire contributor Jeremy Frankel.
Thanks for having me.
As always, we have Cassie Dillon with us tonight.
Hey guys.
And Stephanie McWilliams.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Second time on the panel. All right. And as always, I'm your host, Alex Sears. We're going to get straight into it, everybody. Starting out with the Mooch, Anthony Scaramucci, affectionately called the Mooch, or maybe not affectionately. I don't know. I'm sure a lot of reporters are happy to no longer have to write that nickname. I just think it's hilarious. So, yeah, what's going down in the Trump administration? There was quite a shakeup this past week.
Sure, I can start. First, my heart is broken about the Mooch leaving. He grew on me. I didn't like his tweets are very anti-Trump and just kind of ridiculous, but he grew on me. I'm kind of sad he's gone, to be honest. And you said that the reporters might be happy they're not writing about him anymore, but I can tell you the comedians are crying. I was surprised there wasn't a big protest of comedians outside the White House. And I saw someone say that on Twitter and I thought it was pretty funny. So I'm sad he's gone, but we are seeing General Kelly getting into in the groove. You can see Trump hasn't been tweeting as much, and he hasn't been too crazy on Twitter, and things seem a little bit calmer already. So I'm just really thrilled that we have him. Hopefully he gets things better.
Maybe a little bit more organized. For one thing, I will say I don't really buy that it was General Kelly who wanted to get rid of Scaramucci. I feel like that doesn't make any sense because obviously, if Trump was at any point considering a new chief of staff, I think he would have probably brought it up with him. I don't feel like, unless he found out in the past few weeks, I feel like he would never have hired Scaramucci in the first place if he had any inclination that he was going to hire a new chief of staff that was going to immediately fire him after 10 days on the job. Am I crazy conspiracy theorist here? I feel like it doesn't make sense.
Oh, I don't know. The time frame's kind of weird because we get Scaramucci. Well, Spicer's out, Scaramucci in, and then Priebus, and then Kelly. Like Priebus left, and then Kelly comes in. So I think Scaramucci predates any kind of say General Kelly would have.
But why would he, if he was considering a new chief of staff, do you not think he would have it given him, spoken to him in the slightest way or had any inclination of what his view would be on Scaramucci? I feel like you'd know pretty quickly that General Kelly probably isn't the kind of guy who's going to be cool with someone like Scaramucci and how he talks to reporters and the things he tweets. I don't know. I feel like a lot of the stuff the White House feeds it to the media in a certain way, and I think there's probably things that we're just not able to see going on.
Yeah, I kind of agree with your point there a little bit, but at the same time, I'm actually kind of glad that he is out of the picture. To be honest, there should be some level of professionalism associated with the job of White House Communications Director, and I don't think Scaramucci he didn't symbolize that. He didn't bring a sort of dignity to the job that is expected of someone who is in that position. I'm actually kind of glad if General Kelly did have some sort of input, which I believe he did. I think he did the right thing because General Kelly is a very respected former Marine general, and that anyone who had if there was someone like Scaramucci under his command previously in the Marine Corps, he would have had that taken care of pretty quickly.
So, yeah, I'm gonna also go with that point there. I think that it must have come from that interview, the one where he I'm not gonna repeat the words on it, but I don't know if I'm not really sure what he was thinking, if it was just off the cuff and he didn't know if it was on the record, off the record, whatever that was. And I know Trump kind of likes that stuff. But I got to assume that once Priebus was out, he sort of had no use for him anymore. Kelly comes in. Kelly's a no-nonsense guy. And then he's gone. He's pretty much escorted out, which is it's not even just a resignation. He's just you're fired, get out now. And so it was kind of interesting to see that Priebus goes, and then basically that was the kind of seemed like the point of Scaramucci to begin with. And
That's
okay,
what I
now I
think.
really have no use for you.
Well, I read online that the guy who he did the interview with was actually one of his childhood friends or something like that. So he didn't think there would be a leak or anything like that. He didn't realize that it doesn't matter if you're friends. You need to say you're off the record. Like, that should be the first thing you know as a communications director. And it was funny because he said that he would fire everyone and run the entire department with just him and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and he was the one that leaked. So happens.
I don't really mind so much his I mean, I don't love his comments, but I don't find them to be the biggest problem with his professionalism. I find it more, I think that General Kelly would be a better fit because I think that there are a lot of these sorts of personalities in the administration, including Trump himself. And I think that General Kelly will bring a good balance to it where he kind of keeps some sort of coherent chain of command. I don't think we've seen that as much. I think it's been very, like, the message is different and Trump says it one way and then his communications department says it the other way. I think General Kelly will hopefully kind of keep a coherent order. And that's the kind of professionalism I prioritize personally.
If I could just add on to that, which I fully agree with. I don't know if everybody saw like the stories today where like the head of the National Security Council, H.R. McMaster, he like basically like gave Susan Rice clearance and basically like he's like a real like, I don't have words for it. It I don't even want to call it swamp. There's like, that's an understatement, but like this guy really needs to go, but that's besides the point. The point is what I see now is going now that, when Trump started, he put Priebus and Steve Bannon in who are very not ideologically the same at all.
No,
you have some from the establishment, some from this like sort of outside for lack of a better term. And what I hope for when with Kelly, who's clearly no nonsense, whatever his personal ideology is, I just kind of hope that everybody's just sort of on the same page from now on. Absolutely. Because it's really messed them up in the past.
Yeah, and also another aspect to look at is I once Priebus left and once Kelly came in and once Scaramucci left, I had also been hearing a ton of people discuss this whole 4D chess concept with relation to going to give that the president that much credit in his ability to have some sort of underlying strategy here. There's no operating by chaos here. It's just simply, at least in my opinion, it's incompetence. It's a clash of egos. And
but 4D chess, come on, it's a thing.
It is 0%.
That's like the Sunday school Jesus answer. Like, if you can't have an explanation for the chaos that's going on in the Trump administration, it's just like, oh, they're too smart for us. They know what's going on. We're just like the plebeians down here that aren't going to have any idea.
Okay, I think there's some cases where 4D chess was an actual thing. And I think there's other cases where people just pretended like it was a thing. So there's some things he did that was actually 4D chess. Like, for instance, when he's like, I had this huge announcement. Everyone needs to come. And the press was waiting. He made them wait an hour. And then he brought out a bunch of veterans. That was amazing.
That was great.
So he has, like, awesome things like that. But I think the Scaramucci thing, I don't think this was 4D chess.
I gotta just say, like, I don't really buy the whole 4D chess thing. People are like saying how it's like a total strategy, like he's really like 1,000 steps ahead of everybody. 4D underwater Calvin ball chess, hungry hippos, whatever. I'm just borrowing Ben Shapiro's term here, but it's not that it's incompetence, but like every administration is like this. You see it much more here now because the media is just jumping all over it. But Barack Obama, he had 5 chiefs of staff, 4 secretaries of defense. Ronald Reagan had a lot also. He had a lot of shakeups. I think Obama had a chief of staff that lasted shorter than Priebus. It's not a bad thing. I mean, yeah, people make mistakes and, you know, you go through it. Especially somebody who has no experience, you go through it, you see what works, and whatever doesn't work, you replace. And why is that, like, why are people, like, trying to, like, write it off as, like, something so either so strategic or on the other hand something so dumb?
That's a good point. Do we all like Sarah Huckabee Sanders? Because I absolutely love her. To me, she is like she is the mom who shows up to work with baby puke on her shirt and like makes everyone laugh. And I kind of love her for it. Like I get her. I think she's hilarious.
I miss Sean. And I love Sean. Like his press conferences were the funniest thing ever. I did an archaeology internship in Israel, and when we got bored, you know, we were just like cleaning pottery. We would put it on the background, just laugh while we're cleaning pottery and sitting there with like my entire lab. So I miss Sean Spicer, and it breaks my heart that he's gone.
I didn't dislike Spicer. I just think that I find her, she deals better with the current media. I think she doesn't get flustered. She doesn't accidentally say things about the Holocaust, you know, like, not that I really thought, like, he obviously wasn't denying the Holocaust. Poor Spicer. But I think she handles them well because she doesn't get triggered by their idiotic questions. She just kind of rolls her eyes and is like, okay, I've answered this 20 times. Can we move on? Thanks, guys. She talks like someone who has small children. She does.
One thing we all have to remember though, Melissa McCarthy.
Oh my god.
So good.
No.
That's one thing I will miss is the SNL sketches with her.
Those were
genuinely hilarious. I don't care what side of the political spectrum you are on. Those were funny.
Where she takes out like the super soaker at the end.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Good stuff. Go watch those. That's an endorsement right there. So we're gonna go ahead and move on to our second topic for tonight. We're talking affirmative action. College students or former college students, we've all seen affirmative action and had to deal with its effects. There was some rumors coming out this week that the Trump administration was going to take a swing at it. So, Stephanie, I know that you have some choice thoughts on affirmative action. Do you want to get us started here?
Well, I was just making that face because I'm like, I have never been a college student, so I haven't had to deal with being kind of pushed down for not being part of a minority. But I find affirmative action to be extremely racist, extremely unnecessary. I think that it ends up hurting people way more than it helps them. It continues the narrative that minorities are too dumb to be able to do things on their own. And funny enough, it actually hurts some of the, you know, best performing minorities, such as, you know, Chinese and Japanese people who actually get screwed over in favor of other groups that do not do as well. Statistically, obviously, this is all statistically speaking, not individuals. Statistically speaking, there are certain minority groups that don't do as well in school that are now being pushed ahead of groups who do extremely well, like Asian students. So we're effectively letting more, for example, Black students into schools, which they then have a higher rate of dropping out of, because they give them, basically giving extra points on tests like the SAT. And I just don't see an argument in which that is in any way, and it's not equality. It's giving special privileges to people that only ends up hurting them.
Yeah, I want to add to that. So the Brookings Institute actually said that after affirmative action was implemented, it did nothing to fix the Black poverty rate, which was the main reason why they're saying they need more people in college. Additionally, Princeton University did a study in 2015 and said that Black people get 230 extra points in their SATs out of a 1600 score, and the Asian people get penalized 50 points. Asians actually get penalized more than white people, and Jews get penalized even more than Asian people. So absolutely insane that they have this in the first place. If you want to have some system to balance out the field, you need to have it on economic grounds. And I say that because the poor Asian kid in Los Angeles is having a harder time applying to college than, say, like Ben Shapiro says, Colin Powell's son. Are you kidding me? There's a big, big difference. If you're coming from money, it's easier for you to get into college because you get to, you know, you don't have to work after high school and you don't have to work harder on your homework and be at a house, or maybe your parents are doing drugs, or you have to take care of your brothers and sisters. You come from a position of privilege if you're in a wealthy household, and that makes you more prepared for college. So having it by race is just insulting to people who have grown up with nothing and to people who are really trying hard to go to college and are getting disadvantaged just because of their skin color. It's insane.
Great point.
Yeah, I mean, there are some aspects of affirmative action. So some of the premise behind that, the concept of affirmative action, is potentially good. But just like communism, you know, the idea of it is great, but in practice, it's not. It's a good thing to have people have equal opportunity to go to college, but I don't think that certain groups should be put ahead or of an equally qualified individual from going to college. It shouldn't prevent that person from going to college just because you meet X criteria that is not academic at all, or not, you know, it shouldn't disadvantage other people. So people shouldn't go to college at the expense of other people, basically.
I wouldn't say it's a good theory, even just in theory, and neither is communism. Communism is stealing from other people. So in practice and in theory, communism sucks, and so does affirmative action.
Listen, I'm not advocating for communism at all. Just
we do not endorse communism on this show, guys.
Gotta clarify that.
No,
I have my token commie.
Because I'm Latino, isn't it?
So racist. No, I totally agree with you, Cassie. I think that class has always been the, you know, if you're going to insist on these kind of conversations about privilege and who has an easier time and who doesn't, money has always overruled any other standard for the most part. You know, this is ridiculous that, you know, Barack Obama's children are somehow, you know, they have oppression because they're black, even though they have 50 million times the advantages I have. I mean, it's very silly. And I also think that this idea of putting people, I think it's obviously, I want to encourage people who want to get an education, who are able to do so, to be able to get a post-secondary education. So I'm not angry about there being grants available and things like that, but I don't think that it should be treated as a right. I think that it devalues higher education. I think it makes it something that you just do that doesn't really have value. And for the Black community specifically, there are a lot of reports of how, statistically speaking, these people that clearly would not have gotten in on merit are let in, and then they inevitably can't do the work at the school they're in. They end up dropping out, and that simply feeds into the narrative that, oh, it's because the colleges are too mean to Black students and we need to fix it, and the Black community will never succeed because of evil white people. And I really don't think that's the problem. I think if you let qualified Black students in, you won't have this problem in the first place.
I really just hate treating people differently because of their race. Like, I hate this so much. And at my school, if you are a person of color, let me remind you, my school is 40% international. So we have people from all around the world who come from wealthy families, who are sent from Saudi Arabia and all these different countries to my school to study. But when you graduate, if you are a person of color, you get an extra sash for your graduation and you get an extra ceremony. So that's insane. For someone like me who grew up with a single mom who couldn't barely even feed us, I am considered privileged to these people who are billionaires in their countries. It makes no sense to me at all.
It's ridiculous.
To me, it seems like it kind of goes against everything that America stands for. No one has a right to go to college, in the sense that, like, if somebody just works extremely hard, let's say, and they happen to be white, and then somebody who doesn't and then happens to just have been born the, I guess, correct skin color, they have more of a right to something that I earned, but I happen to be white. You know what I mean? Like, to me, it's sort of like communism in the sense that they're stealing my achievements from me and giving it to the other person who didn't do anything. And I'm just gonna also back up the point that, like, let's say somebody, it's not good for the person either. They end up, let's say, for example, a Black student who should go to just like a regular normal state school ends up getting into Harvard just because of affirmative action. And then they flunk out because it's just really hard. I'm not that they're not smart, but like,
it's hard.
It's hard, exactly. So then they end up becoming the college dropout. They end up extremely demoralized. They're not going to go back to college. They'll blame it on the system, and then they'll just be back where they started.
I'm just kind of really surprised that this has even been allowed to exist, because, well, first of all, if you look into what the Department of Justice is, if you believe these kind of leaked reports, what the Department of Justice is calling affirmative action, and it's intentional race-based discrimination. And if that doesn't sound like institutionalized racism, I'm not sure what else would. So we have a federal institutionalized racist system that's controlling our higher education publicly and privately. And most people seem to be pretty fine with it.
Not only that, but most people seem to think we have institutionalized racism against minorities, despite the fact that I have, in several years of talking about this sort of thing, not had a single person been able to actually prove where it exists in law whatsoever. You can easily prove that, you know, like you said, affirmative racial discrimination does exist. So which one is more real? This ghost of institutional racism that no one can point to, or this very real problem that, like you said, I'm not sure why it is, has been around as long as it has.
Because apparently only whites can be racist.
That seems to be the, that seems
unless
to be.
Unless you are exactly. a black conservative, exactly. then you can be racist. So racist.
Against or yourself. Anyone who's not a leftist can be a racist.
There you go.
Exactly.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and move on from affirmative action. Good conversation there.
All racist.
We're going to talk about North Korea. Fun times and foreign policy. So we all know how great we all are at foreign policy. But we're going to talk about how much North Korea just needs a smack in the face. It's pretty much my view of things. I mean, there's a whole lot of complexities to this. You have China that's backing North Korea that isn't doing anything. And Trump is completely right on when it comes to this, when he asked China to deal with North Korea. That's completely fine for Trump to do because China is a major backer of North Korea, on paper or not. It's, you know, pretty solidly that they help him out. And then you have the whole kind of issue where, oh, if we decide to start, you know, shooting missiles and doing on North Korea, the capital of South Korea is within mortar distance of the non-aggression line that splits the two countries. So the situation can devolve really quickly when it comes to involved with North Korea and China. What kind of thoughts are you all having on this?
Well, I mean, you kind of hit it on the head there. There are a lot of complexities to take into account. There are a lot of things, a lot of players, a lot of interests. It's not a simple, you know, we should stand up to North Korea and that's it. We should fight aggression with aggression. There are a lot of complexities into it. You know, we have to take into account, you know, China. We have to take into account Japan. We have to take into account South Korea. We have to take into account Russia, even who share a border with North Korea. So it's not an easy situation to analyze, and I don't think there's a simple solution to the issue. Obviously, we should demonstrate some sort of strength, or else North Korea could very well take advantage of the situation, but there's no easy answer. You know, clearly I'm a super expert on foreign policy, but I think that, you know, a lot of analysis needs to go into it before we decide to do anything specific about it.
Okay, so I was at the State Department a few weeks ago, and I was listening to a speech about this. And I've taken a couple classes on nuclear proliferation, and we just need to get rid of the myth right now that North Korea is going to give up their nuclear weapons. It's not going to happen. They're not giving it up. They're not going anywhere. I don't think that the action we need to have right now is aggression towards them. I think what we need to do, because obviously that's just not realistic. You're going to put South Korea at some serious risk. So what you need to do right now is you need to make sure our missile system or missile defense system in South Korea is doing okay. And then I think Japan needs to get on the nuclear train because they've been discussing it and it's been a big topic right now in their country. And I think if they start moving towards that, it's gonna scare China. And China's gonna realize that maybe North Korea is a liability, because that's what we need to do. We need to stop making North Korea an asset to China, and they need to become a liability. So doing that would be putting a missile defense system, because that really scares China, and then also getting Japan to start moving into their means of their own defense. Obviously, we'll still have them under the United States umbrella of nuclear defense, but I think they need to start showing that they're being serious and get China moving, because that's the only way to get rid of North Korea and get them to stop being hostile is China.
Well, at the same time, I do understand the purpose of Japanese nuclear weapons. I'm not sure how China or Russia would think of that, having nuclear power in the region there so close.
That's the point.
Maybe, you know, perhaps threatening Japan having nuclear weapons, but that may create another dilemma separate from North Korea, where you have the Chinese getting more involved, not in the case of pressuring North Korea, but pressuring Japan itself and the United States. So while I understand the idea and it could work, I don't think that it would be a white and black type of solution where, you know, Japan gets nukes, North Korea will back off.
Well, absolutely not. I don't think that either. But I think what it will do is it'll make North Korea a liability. And I think if Japan says, hey, if you guys aren't going to do anything about this, we're going to move towards it. Because when Trump was first going in, they weren't sure if the alliance would hold because Trump was saying America first. And it kind of scared all of our allies to hear that, even though they've come out and said, that's no, we're just talking about leading, not just being isolationist. So I think that Japan was already prepping for this. They're already talking about it. They've been discussing it in their country. And so I think they just need to show that they're serious because North Korea is not an expansionist country. They don't want to take over South Korea. They just want to, you know, keep the regime going. And they'll do whatever they need to do that, which is scary because they don't care about their people. They care about having their power, which means they have no problem with nuking someone if they really feel like there's a threat to the regime, which is terrifying.
So I'm going to just disagree here with respectfully disagree.
It's fine.
I don't think China is going to be a huge deal. I mean, like, think about it this way. Like, what is China going to do? I mean, yeah, they're not, like, friendly with North Korea. It's an ally out of convenience. And their economy is a lot smaller than ours. I know they have a lot of our debt, et cetera, but their economy is tiny compared to ours. And I think that the threat of any kind of Chinese aggression is a little bit overhyped. So, I mean, how long are we going to wait while they're testing all these missiles before we do something about it? I mean, for all we know, we can get hit in another test. They already have something that can hit California. And so why not just take them out? You know, like, I know that sounds a little bit...
Neocon?
Just a little bit. I don't mean like regime change. I just mean just like take out the threat and, you know...
That's just not realistic.
Well, I don't see why not.
Well, what you said was that they're allies for convenience. That's exactly what I'm saying. You need to make North Korea a liability. And right now, China is North Korea's lifeline. I think they get like 90% of their goods and services and all of their imports from China. So you just really need to get China to put the pressure on them. And I don't think attacking North Korea is a solution. They're actually signed on to the NPT. And they left the NPT because they said that their regime was in threat, which is a part of the NPT where you can leave the NPT. So that's a flaw with the NPT I have a problem with. But they see it as, well, you have nukes. Why can't I have nukes? So I don't think you need to nuke them. I think you need to get them to start being serious. And I think China's the way to do it. Invading is not smart because if we do that or we do attack them, A, you're killing civilians who don't really know what the outside world's like. And B, you're really putting South Korea at risk big time. They don't even need to use their nuclear weapons to take out South Korea.
I hear that, but this is the same guy that shot his uncle with an anti-aircraft missile. Like, he's somebody who can't be negotiated with. Like, there's not really much, like, what pressure can you put on somebody like that?
You don't negotiate. We tried negotiating with them. We offered them money, and it just didn't work. They took the money, and then they went back to the way they were. You just need to put pressure on them, and you need to strangle them economically. That's the first thing you need to do, and we haven't got it to happen because China's just not cooperating
at all on this. But my thinking on this whole thing, to Cassie's point, is that if negotiating them with giving them money doesn't work, I'm not entirely convinced that cutting off their economic needs is going to work either, because ultimately they can probably still sustain themselves for quite a while with what they have in their country, sustaining the leaders, because they clearly don't give a damn about their people. They care about the upper echelons. Most people are starving. So I'm really, but at the same time, I also really struggle with the idea of military action against them, because when people are just saying on Twitter, saying, oh, just nuke them and do this. And I'm like, I obviously feel for people that are in the country that have never known anything else. I feel for people in South Korea who are probably terrified that they are literally next door to these utter lunatics. There's a lot of people in play, and obviously I'm not the kind of person to be able to discuss this. I'm not a foreign policy expert. I'm not a military general, but I do think that ultimately what I gain from this is this should never have been able to get this far. there are people that cannot be reasoned with. They never should, they should have, like, they should have killed them all 50 years ago. Like, not everybody, but, like, the leaders. Like, this, the idea that you can negotiate with people that think they're God isn't going to work. You know, and I agree with you on that. They're, it's a scary thing because they are not like most world leaders.
And that's actually what they tried to do 50 years ago. I think it was during the presidency of Harry Truman, right after the Korean War, when his general actually wanted to go into North Korea, unite the peninsula, and get rid of Kim Il-sung, who's Kim Jong-un's grandfather. And Truman decided not to do it, I think just because he wanted to end the war. And it was also like bad PR, et cetera, and didn't really, he very much underestimated what was really going on.
I need to research the history more, but that's my impression. I'm just like, I feel like so many of these things would have been easier before all this technology, before all this, because now we just created this monster. And that's what I fear with not really taking strong action, is that it's just going to continue to get worse. But I'm hopeful it can be resolved peacefully.
And this is what's going to happen in 50 years if Iran...
Exactly. I know we're running out of time, so I wanted to leave with that piece of advice, is let this serve as an example of what could happen with Iran.
I think what it boils down to is how far or how much the U.S. will play defense on this one. How many missiles will we shoot out of the sky? How many times will we let North Korea poke the bear before they get wiped off the face of the planet? And on that happy, joyful thought, that's going to wrap us up tonight. So, Carlos, why don't you start us off? Tell us where we can find you online. Tell us what you're doing.
You can find me on Twitter at Chuck E. Chavez with an S at the end. You'll find some of my articles on Lone Conservative. And yeah, just find me on Twitter.
All right, Jeremy?
So you could find me at Frankel Jeremy on Twitter. So that's my last name and my first name. You could find me at the Daily Wire. I also write at Red Alert and the New Americana. But yeah, I'm mostly on Twitter. I'm literally on there all day. Just,
welcome to my life.
Aren't we all?
Me too.
All right, Cassie.
You can find me on Twitter at Cassie Dillon, but I just want to remind you all that we are really trying to grow our Lone Conservative Facebook presence. So if you go on Facebook and you type facebook.com/loneconservative, please give us a like, invite your friends. We really want to hit 15,000 by the end of the month, and we're about to hit 13,000, so that's really exciting.
Awesome.
Steph?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter. I am also a complete Twitter addict, at Steph McWilliams, and you can find me at halseynews.com. I write articles there, or you can find me on YouTube for my YouTube show, Right Millennial.
All righty. And just a quick plug everything, make sure to follow On The Line TV on Twitter. Keep up with all of our episodes, as well as follow Lone Conservative on Twitter. It's L-O Conservative. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Sears AL. And I just like to thank Jeremy again for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great episode. Hope we can do more stuff with you in the future.
Absolutely, anytime.
We'll see y'all next week.